The scripture reading this evening is from cosmologist Carl Sagan. It's the way he ends his Cosmos series. We are the local embodiment of a cosmos grown to self-awareness. We have begun to contemplate our origins, star stuff pondering the stars.
As I was contemplating speaking about good news, gospel, from the science perspective, what does science tell us? What does evolution tell us that could qualify as really great news? I thought it was rather intimidating to share this on a day when we've experienced in the last week the largest decline in the stock market since the Great Depression. I think most of us are probably in the mood for a little good news, and I don't know to what extent this perspective will make a difference for millions of people or billions of people on this planet, but for at least thousands and possibly tens or hundreds of thousands of us, this is where we ground our faith, our trust, our inspiration. And when I say this, what I'm meaning is the whole history of cosmos, earth, life, and humanity as one sacred story, as one meaningful myth, in the way that Joseph Campbell used the term myth, not as an untrue story, but as a narrative that puts us in accord with the nature of reality, that which helps us feel our connection to the whole. See, there's some things, one of the great, I think, inaccuracies that's being perpetrated right now, there's almost a collusion that you've got atheists and fundamentalists that are kind of agreeing, although I don't think they're meaning to agree, but they're agreeing on the same fallacy, which is that if you really understood science, if you really understood evolution, you'd be left with a meaningless, depressing worldview. And if you ask the average person, what do you think of? If you were to say what evolution is in a nutshell, what would you say it is? Well, the two phrases that people come up with usually are nature, red, and tooth and claw, which is basically simply a way of saying that creatures eat other creatures and that's how life continues, or survival of the fittest. And that's what most people think evolution is, survival of the fittest and nature, red, and tooth and claw. And so, yeah, if that's what you characterize as this 14-billion-year amazing epic that has now given us the world that we now live in all its complexity, well, sure, that's a pretty depressing, or at least it's a pretty narrow way of understanding. So what I'd like to focus on just in our brief time together this evening are some other things that are going on that actually can give us a huge amount of inspiration. For example, one of the things, and what I'm sharing with you is not controversial. This is what 97 or 98% of the scientists of the world would agree with. That the universe as a whole is a sequence of irreversible transformations in measurable time. That is, we don't believe that the universe is billions of years old. We can measure it. We know it. It's 13.73 billion years old. We don't believe that there has been a sequence of transformations going from simple to more complex. We can measure this. We can actually see this happening now. In fact, I'll be on my program on Wednesday night. I've got a whole bunch of Hubble Space Telescope shots, I mean, huge pictures and stuff. But one of the things that we know is that the universe has gone from simple atoms. First, it was just hydrogen, simplest atom, and then more complex atoms, and then molecules, and more complex molecules, and creatures, and more complex creatures, and societies, and more complex societies. And this is one emergent, unfolding process that we can see is a divine process. That there's this creativity that keeps creating greater complexity, greater interdependence, and greater cooperation at larger and wider scale. The universe as a whole has gone through this process. At one time here on Earth, all there were linked molecules. There was no complexity. There was no cooperation beyond linked molecules. And then the first most primitive form of bacteria, prokaryotic bacteria. And then they faced a major pollution crisis caused by photosynthesis, and a new level of complexity emerged with the eukaryotic cell, and then multicellularity, and then so on. And then in the human realm, at one time we cooperated among our family and clan, and everybody else was the threat. And then with beliefs, with words, basically with moral codes, with speech, we could cooperate at the scale of, say, 200 or 300 people, a tribe. I mean, how are you going to get 200 people to cooperate? It's not going to happen instinctually. We're not naturally going to cooperate with 200 or 300 people. It's just too complex. It takes beliefs. It takes moral codes. And then we start cooperating at the scale of a chiefdom or a kingdom, not 7, 8, 10,000 years ago. And then theocracies in early nations, once we had writing and mathematics, and so on. And we see this process, and the key piece is the aligning of the self-interest of the parts with the well-being of the whole that the parts are part of. So if the parts do well to the larger whole that they're part of, they benefit. And the more good they do, the more they benefit. And if the parts harm the whole, there's some cost or disadvantage to the parts. So it's in their self-interest to do well to the whole, and it's also in their self-interest to not harm the whole. That's the primary thing that drives complexity in evolution. And what that does is it gives us clear guidance for what we need to do to move into a just, healthy, beautiful, sustainably life-giving future. And the reason that for 6.5 years, Connie and I have been living on the road, I mean permanently traveling North America, I mean, we don't have a home. We don't even have a storage bin. I mean, we live permanently out of the generosity of people who open up their homes to us. And the reason we do this is we're committed to doing everything that we possibly can in our lifetime to ensure a thriving future for planet Earth and as many other species as possible. And the key piece is aligning the natural self-interest of individuals, corporations, and nation states with the well-being of the planet as a whole. So that individuals, corporations, and nations that do well to the larger common good benefit, and the more good they do, the more they benefit. And individuals, corporations, and nation states that disregard or harm the common good are taxed or penalized or there's moral strictures. So that it's in their self-interest to do the right, just, ecological thing, and it's also in their self-interest to not do the unjust, unecological thing. I mean, this is not rocket science. Bacteria figured out how to do this twice without brains. Maybe that's a problem, you know? But where we get this, see, this is the interesting thing. Where we get this information for how to move forward are not sacred texts 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, as inspiring as they are for many of us, but where we get them is from the scriptures of the universe itself. There's a whole piece that I'll be doing on Wednesday night on the fact that facts are revelatory, that every fact discovered by science is reality revealing itself to the human. To use God language, that God's word, facts are God's native tongue, to use God language. Now, you don't have to use divine language, but many people feel free to do that. But this understanding that facts are God's native tongue, what it means is where we go to for guidance from the whole of reality is not first and foremost texts in the past. Where we go to first is what God, what reality as a whole, is revealing through the entire range of sciences today. I mean, who of us would let a first century dentist fill our children's teeth? Yet so many of us, or so many of our neighbors, let first century theologians fill their children's minds every day. It's because we haven't had these distinctions. We haven't seen science is sacred. Science is a holy endeavor. Now, one of the other things that we understand about this that's hopeful, that's good news, is that when you look at the whole history of life, right? Because we've got billions of years. We've got tremendous evidence in all the different geological and biological disciplines and cosmological disciplines. The universe is not just a friendly, happy, put on a smile, isn't a nice day, it's all wonderful kind of place. There's chaos and destruction and breakdown and violence and extinctions. In fact, you can't even have a universe without this destructive, chaotic side. Chaos plays an absolutely essential role, perhaps the most essential role. In fact, they've taken computer programs that are evolution programs. In other words, they're designed to simulate the dynamics of evolution, and they are boring until you add chaos. And only when chaos is added do we find dynamic evolution happening. This is the way life works, real life. I mean, think about your own life. I mean, I can't speak for you, but the most difficult, challenging, painful times in my life, the kind of times I would not want to have to relive, have also unquestionably been the most important growing times. And so what we do, we see this chaos, destruction, breakdown, violence, extinctions, catalyzing creativity. In fact, let me say it as strongly as I possibly can. The primary driver for billions of years of evolutionary creativity and transformation, like the number one thing that has catalyzed and furthered the process of evolution for billions of years, is chaos, breakdowns, and bad news. Now, I don't know about you, for me, in the current political and economic situation, that gives me a little bit of hope. See, I mean, again, to step into religious language for a moment, on this, the other side of every Good Friday is Resurrection Sunday. This is not simply true about what happened to one God-man 2,000 years ago. This is also true about the entire nature of the universe, that we see this pattern over and over. It may be the fundamental pattern in evolutionary history. And so when I look at that, I look at the challenges that we're likely to deal with. Well, first of all, the financial crisis that we're in the smack in the middle of right now, or perhaps just in the beginning of, we just don't know. But I also look at the challenges that we're likely to deal with in the next 50, 70 years as a species. Global warming, overpopulation, species extinction, the growing gap between the rich and the poor. And these are huge issues. Peak oil. These are big issues. And yet, when you understand this dynamic and begin to trust that process, we can look at these challenges square on. We don't have to deny them. We can look at them square on and realize that people living 200 years from now will most likely look back on the challenges that we and our grandchildren and children are likely to deal with. And from their vantage point, 200 years from now or 100 years from now looking back, they're likely to say, thank God they had those problems. Because if it weren't for these major challenges that we and our children and grandchildren are going to have to deal with, we would not be forced to make the kind of major positive changes that we're going to have to make. I mean, this is, again, one of the things that we learn from evolution, is that no creature and no species has evolved and made any kind of major change unless it was forced to. All species, the major transformations in evolutionary history have almost always been catalyzed by some major difficulty. And now we're in a situation, for example, I read yesterday, I don't know if this is true or not, but I read yesterday that the Prime Minister of Italy was saying that they may close the global markets for a few days or longer all over the world until the major political leaders and economists around the world rewrite the rules of the game. This would not be happening if it weren't for the chaos that we've been experiencing. And I'm not saying that the chaos is over. We might have all kinds of other economic and stuff. Because here's the thing. Think about it. Governance, how we govern ourselves as a species. Economics, how we organize the distribution and the movement of materials and wealth and skills and information. How we educate, how we share information with the next generation so that they can hopefully thrive. And then religion, how we stand in awe and reverence and humility towards whatever we want to call ultimacy, and then how we live in lives of greater love and compassion and generosity and so forth. These four things, governance, economics, education, and religion, all of these emerged, that is, they came into being, we conceptualized these things before we had an evolutionary worldview. So the great work of our time, the great work of our generations, will be to reformulate what does governance look like that's an evolutionary governance, that's, in other words, that's wise in terms of evolution, the patterns of evolution. What does education look like? What's economics look like, evolutionary economics? And this is the most fruitful, exciting things that are happening on the planet, is revisioning evolutionary religion, evolutionary education, evolutionary governance, and evolutionary economics. My book, Thank God for Evolution, is an attempt to say what does religion, what could all religions look like in its just as broad contours that not only tolerates evolution but wholeheartedly embraces it. And I think one of the reasons that five Nobel Prize winning scientists as well as theologians and ministers and rabbis and whatever have endorsed my book is because it at least begins to give voice to this move in terms of humans grounding our most important institutions in measurable reality, what science is revealing to us. And that's good news. The last thing I'll share this evening, and again, I'll go into a lot of this stuff in much more depth on Wednesday night, but the last thing I want to share this evening is that from a personal standpoint, okay, we're talking about the collective, but let's talk personally. As individuals, as family members, what's good news? Well, one of the things that science, that evolution gives us as good news is a sense of our own brain's creation story. We now have a sense of why we are the way that we are, why we struggle with the things that we struggle with, why we are tempted by the things that we are tempted by, why we fall to the things that we fall to. Why is it that we all seem to struggle with more or less the same kinds of issues in one way or another? Well, we have a pretty clear understanding of that. now from a measurable way. I mean, there's always been mythic ways. There's always been traditional religious ways of trying to describe these. For example, the fall of Adam and Eve and original sin are mythic night language intuitions, very accurate intuitions about the fact that we all have an unchosen nature. We all have inherited proclivities. For example, who of us in this room chooses to be attracted to foods that have sugars, salts, and fats? Anybody? You may think you choose it. You don't have to choose it. It's been chosen for you. In other words, it's our unchosen nature, because for 99% of human history, it wasn't easy to find sugar, salts, and fats. So having a craving for these things allowed our ancestors to survive long enough to reproduce. Yet today, it's very easy to find sugar, salts, and fats, yet we still have these cravings. Did you know that there is a scientifically proven correlation between the amount of testosterone in a human organism and how much that human being, male or female, tends to take risks and tends to think about sex? And when status rises, testosterone levels will rise for all men and many women. Now, this is going to make sense of some of the recent political and religious scandals, right? But see, having an understanding of our brain makes it easier, far easier, to stay in integrity. This is not an excuse. It makes it infinitely easier to stay in integrity when we have an understanding of what's really going on. Because one of the things that we learn is that there is one way to a healthy future as a species. And that one way is to be in integrity with the way things really are. That is the evolutionary way things really are. So when we align our laws, our medicine, our politics, our economics, our education with the way life works, we can move into a just, healthy, sustainable future. To the degree that we ignore these or think that our role is to dominate nature, we're out of touch with reality and we're going to suffer the consequences. But as individuals, there is also only one way to have healthy, thriving relationships. And that one way is also to be in integrity with the way things really are. And that's why this notion of evolutionary integrity, deep integrity, is essential to our understanding of freedom or salvation or enlightenment or what health or whatever you want to call this state where our relationships thrive no matter what. Because life sometimes deals us a lousy hand. Compost happens. It's just part of reality. And yet, that compost can actually serve as tremendous growth potential when we are in integrity. So again, I'll be going into a lot of this in a lot more depth on Wednesday night, but I just wanted to just briefly give a sense of some of the things that from a sacred, meaningful, inspiring interpretation of the history of the universe, how we can understand life in a way that's gospel, that's such good news, we want to just tell people about it. I mean, Connie and I for 6.5 years have been homeless because we're so excited to tell people about this stuff. And fortunately, there's a lot, I mean, it goes beyond us. There's people in every religious tradition now that are doing what Connie and I are doing, not necessarily living on the road traveling, but taking this message of good news to their people. Buddhists are doing it. Hindus are doing it. Jews are doing it. Muslims are doing it. It's happening in all circles. In fact, 2 years ago, I gave the exact same program, what I'm going to be doing here Wednesday night, much of the same program I delivered in Colorado Springs, Colorado, on Tuesday night to a group of Christians. On Wednesday night, I gave the exact same program to a group of atheists, agnostics, and free thinkers, and then did a survey, and more than 80% of both groups loved the program. Now, that tells me we're onto something. Because if we don't find ways of cooperating across ethnic and religious differences in the next 30 to 50 years, we are in serious trouble as a species. And fortunately, the sacred evolutionary perspective now is our common creation story. It's our common creation myth. I'd like to close with a quote from Brian Swim. He's a world-class cosmologist and a physicist. And this will give you a sense of why Connie and I live on the road and why we'll probably live on the road the rest of our lives. And it goes like this. I am convinced that the story of the universe that's come out of 3 centuries of modern scientific work will be recognized as a supreme human achievement, the scientific enterprise's central gift to humanity. I'm convinced, he says, that the story of the universe that's come out of 3 centuries of modern scientific work will be recognized as a supreme human achievement, the scientific enterprise's central gift to humanity. For the first time in human history, We finally have a creation story that's not tied to one cultural tradition nor to a political ideology, but instead gathers every human group into its meanings. We are in the midst of a revelatory experience of the universe that must be compared in its magnitude with those of the great religious revelations. And we need only wander about telling this great story to ignite a transformation of humanity. Connie and I have taken that last sentence very literally. Thank you.